Good day, all. My name is Patrick. I'm a lovable guy and an alcoholic. And what a pleasure this is to have this moment to introduce my bosom buddy, lifelong pal. I'll just take a minute to talk about that because it's been a long road for he and I in so many ways. Joe came to our group in 1985 when I was a whippersnapper myself, not quite the age he was, but and then in suburban Toronto, there was three of us under 30 years old in a group of almost maybe 90, right? Whereas, Toronto itself had lots of young whippersnappers like Joe, not quite that young again, but a different sort of climate. So to be sitting there and have this guy come to speak, and he's got 8 years of sobriety, and he looks like he was a handsome young fella too, I'll tell you, people. And funny and charming, and it was an encouraging thing, and I was drawn to him immediately, and our we had another mutual friend, Joe, who is no longer with us, and because of him, our paths crossed, fairly regularly. But it wasn't until around 1990 that our friendship really started to go to a different level. I went through a horrific time, life-threatening time, and my buddy was there. Gets me so emotional thinking of that time and the meaning of it, Just he doesn't just talk about this shit or write books about it. He lives it. And I tell you quickly, I was fortunate to have another Joe C as a sponsor for 19 years, and that guy, he helped me learn how to be a human being, how to love myself, how to, present to the world, just how to bring the best me I could, And he was a devout Catholic, and I had been raised Catholic, went to Catholic high school even, but never had any use for it. And even though he started his day in the Catholic Church, not once did he ever say, "Oh, Patrick, why don't you think about coming back to the church or whatever?" He took what he needed from it and left the rest, and I left it all, right? But that didn't stop me from learning from him so much. My point here is that Joe was a man who woke up each day thinking, "What can I do with it for the alcoholic who still suffers?" And he got sober in 1945 and was sober about 60 years when he died. And to his dying day, it was, "What can I do for the alcoholic who still suffers?" The young whippersnapper, Joe C, I see exactly the same behavior and the same approach, that it's not just words, it's a man who brings things to the table every day, in the hope that those that still suffer can be helped. And if he can reach his hand out, he always has, and that's important. I used to get a kick out of that, that one was very much an agnostic and the other was a devout, and I had these Joe C's that had different approaches to the game, but the same bottom line in how they reached out to others. And as I say, for me personally, that be his support of me through the darkness was, I'll never forget it, And our relationship has just grown and grown and grown over these decades. And, it's my great pleasure to call him my best friend. I had stepped away from meetings. There's one other thing there where I just couldn't take traditional anymore after decades of attending. And I didn't float away. I mean, I still sponsored people. I still lived what I believed was a sober life. I didn't feel threatened that I was going to drink, but I wasn't attending. And then it wasn't till the Zoom thing hit. I had been to, to beyond belief, the physical meeting in Toronto, several times for anniversaries and that. I took people that I sponsored, and two of them started agnostic meetings. But I never made the leap. It's like I stopped going to traditional, but had this loyal approach to it, or some fucked up thing. I don't know what it was, right? But it wasn't until Zoom and Joe said to me, "Why don't you come on along? There's a meeting in Toronto that could use a bit of support, and let's see if there's something there." And that began it. That began the road here for me in secular. And oh my God, what a fresh view this is! It's everything that I needed, And again, it was just something where he reached his hand out to his buddy and said, "Hey, why don't you, came in, pulled me out of the church." And no, I'm just kidding. But again, to get going with this part of the journey and to the new approach, you know, even, you know, it's when I introduced myself as an alcoholic. Like, language is important to me today. When I introduced myself as a lovable guy, I need to do that because of the terrible self-image that I had for so long and how hard the work was to find that place, you know. And even like, you know, I'm never going to talk to myself as an alky. Or, you know, language like that, it just doesn't fit for me. So when I hear people introducing themselves, part of me is an alcoholic or I'm a person in recovery. You know, I just need to make the leap, right? But I like the new language there. And I feel like every meeting I go to, I learn something because these voices, your voices, so many of you who suffered in silence, for lack of a better term, I didn't know in traditional that so many secular people existed. I just didn't, right? Anyway, I don't want to get off rambling on me, but for sure I don't. But I do want to say how important it is that I have the relationship with Josie that I have, and my love for him is unconditional. That's a fact. He's walked through some very, very dark things and stayed the course. And I'm proud of you. And what you do here, I'm most proud of. You know, there's 100 people here for this pop-up meeting that our dear friend Mark, and Mark, thank you for having the wherewithal. You always jump in to provide something like this. And look at this. This is fantastic. And let's have a celebration here of, you know, of one man's life. But as it relates to Alcoholics Anonymous, isn't that really what the celebration is? Without AA, what the hell are any of us doing here? And how did Joe get sober? Doesn't matter if he had a different view of the traditional. It's still the fellowship. It's still the caring for each other and the program. So anyway, that's it. Much love. And this is a happy day for me too. So thank you, my friend. And tell us about those years.
Wow. I really thought, you know, 47 isn't a big deal. You know, I don't know what I did on my belly button 47th birthday because who cares? You know, 50 be a big deal, 40 be a big deal. And I've never stayed sober a year. So it's not like here we are another year, right? It's day at a time. But for my American cousins, this is you know, sort of I well, now it's called Cyber Monday, I guess, but it's that holiday time, Thanksgiving, and then leading up to the solstice and all of the holidays around there. And what you can tell about someone who got sober the 27th of November, whether it was 1976 when I did or any other time, is certainly, I don't know about everybody, but it was certainly true of me. I didn't think for a minute it was my last drink. In fact, I didn't even think for a minute it was my last drink that year. You know, if I was serious about quitting drinking, I would have waited until after New Year's, you know, like that, because it's perfect time, right? You got, okay, this is my last run up to recovery. I'm gonna just sort of, you know, finish with a bang. Got a month and a few days, and let's go crazy. Let's get nuts. And but I was a run by the seat of the pants kind of alcoholic and drug addict. And I've been kind of a run by the seat of the pants kind of recovery person too. And I was something, my first meeting, I was 14 and would have been 1974. And sometime between the time I went to my first meeting and was did not want what you had. Thank you, but what's behind door number two? Really, you know, it just doesn't look, you know, somehow dying a tragic alcoholic death seemed more romantic than living sober, which seemed like a punishment, seemed like going to jail, seemed like, didn't seem like starting all over again. It seemed like giving up and getting caught and having to pay the price. That's all I saw in sobriety. I didn't see any of the good. I just saw what I was giving up. And, you know, as bad as it was, I, you know, was holding out for, you know, I, what door number two looked like for me is to party the way I was partying without any of the consequences. You know, where's that program? And because if, you know, I was being honest with you, that's what I wanted. But between the time that I went to my first meeting and November 27th, 1976, Alcoholics Anonymous, through the help of Barry L., who brought us just a couple years earlier, Living Sober, compiled a bunch of stories and put out a pamphlet called Do You Think You're Different? Originally, they were going to call it So You Think You're Different, but they just thought that was a little too cheeky, and so they changed it to Do You Think You're Different? And in that pamphlet, there's Ed, a real atheist. there's Jan, an agnostic. And there's Diane, a teenager. And like I said, that pamphlet didn't exist when I came to my first meeting. And at the time they wrote that pamphlet, and, you know, there's high bottom, low bottom, famous people, LGBTQIA, just all sorts of people who are run the potential of feeling marginalized in an AA meeting. And they thought that that'd be the last pamphlet. It was P13, the 13th pamphlet AA put out. To give you some context, the God word, agnostics and atheists in AA, was P86. So I have to check that. So we have actually produced a lot more pamphlets since then, but they thought this is it. You know, how many pamphlets can we manage? I mean, a dozen should be enough. Let's close it off there. That's our favorite number. But they produced this 13th pamphlet called Do You Think You're Different? And it talks about people who don't believe in a prayer answering, sobriety granting type of higher power, a personal God. They don't believe in that, and they found a place in AA. Someone else who's never had a legal drink, who had a life of sex and drugs and alcohol, and couldn't get sober on their own either until they found a buddy, someone their own age, someone who spoke about addiction and recovery in our own language. Bob and Bill were both from Vermont. They were both, you know, sort of fallen by the wayside, upper middle class, white male privilege, heteronormative guys, and they could speak each other's language. And not from their first meeting, but eventually they would both stay sober. And I think that's the key to all recovery, is someone who's been where I've been tells their story, which I relate to, and I feel empowered to share my story without rejection. I think that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is. and I'm a happy member of several other recovery groups too. And that magic happens everywhere. We know that whether it's an Eightfold Path or a 12-step process or positive affirmations or cognitive behavioral therapy, people are finding recovery just like I did when I came and found you. And I didn't even have to have a sincere desire to stop drinking. Good thing they took that word out. I think we could do without a lot of the adjectives. Or, like having had an experience as a result of the 12 steps would include everybody. Like, it's hard to do the work without being changed by it. And you add an adjective. The other one I love is rigorous honesty. I'm curious what the other kinds of honesty are. I think, there's only one kind, and it includes rigorous. Otherwise, you keep saying this word. I do not think it means what you think it means. And I mentioned this pamphlet, Do You Think You're Different? Because they were writing about it in Box 459, News and Notes from the General Service Office, because they're rewriting it. They are collecting new stories to present the wide diversity of Alcoholics Anonymous in, the third decade of Century 21 instead of, 1976. And I think that's awesome. And I'm sharing that information from you because they're looking for stories. And think about it, 500 to 800 words. Send a story in. If you came to AA and you felt, I don't know if this can work for me. I mean, I had a lot of things that were working against me. One is I tried to get sober because I was ashamed and I didn't want to let people down. I tried to get sober because I could see that other people died from addiction, and my alcohol addiction could and probably would kill me. In very short order, I found myself in the emergency department of the Lakeshore General Hospital in Montreal, Quebec. Always, in the early hours of Saturday, always drunk, right? And I didn't draw the connection, and none of the doctors did there. I mean, there's better record keeping now. Maybe if a teenager arrived at the same emergency department, and 3 Saturdays before their legal drinking age, drunk, maybe they would, have a record of that and see identify a pattern. Once I was found face up in my own vomit, the morning after the night before in the boys' changing room of the high school arena, which was right beside the high school where I was about to go to a dance to it was actually we were crashing it because we were in grade 9 and it was a grade 8 dance, and we were going to show them how to party. I don't know if I ever got in there because I passed out, fell down. The last thing I remember was they were saying that I could hear the music starting in the gymnasium, and we were outside drinking tequila. And I'd been drinking all day, and I was lying there, and they were saying, get up, and I wanted to. I couldn't move. And the last thing I remember as I was fading was a tug at my feet, and someone was saying, I'll just tie his shoes to the bicycle rack. He'll be fine. Let's go. Like I'm a dog or a horse or something. And I don't know what happened between then and the morning that I woke up in emergency. There were just fluorescent lights above my head. I was had a headache, not unfamiliar with that. My stomach was in knots, not unfamiliar with that. There was a small window with light coming out, just like we see behind me here. And so I figured out, okay, what day is it? What time is it? Like it's not, Friday night anymore. But at first I thought I was in the school. I was very disoriented, and I learned that I'd had my stomach pumped. I w was thought for dead when the ambulance arrived. And in the toxicology report, apparently I did cocaine for the first time in my life, which is outside of my socioeconomic range. So who knows what happened between the last thing I remember and the next thing I remember. And there was a doctor with a clipboard, horn-rimmed glasses, saying something to me like, young man, I hope you feel lucky to be alive. I felt a lot of things at that moment, but lucky to be alive does not describe at all what my experience was. So this was not someone who understood what I was going through, like another member of AA would. And I didn't really listen to everything he had to say. He meant well, of course he did. And I did. What did I feel? I felt horrified that I didn't know what had happened, afraid that I'd done something to embarrass myself or cause some sort of trouble that would have harmed somebody else. I just, it was like I couldn't grab my phone and ch see who I texted last and see what pictures I posted on Facebook. I had to wait till Monday. Can you imagine to find out what happened? And how I'm going to get home, that was a thought. And so I wasn't scared. That didn't scare me. I was encouraged to go to an AA meeting after each of these trips. The next trip was I was beat up by some Satan's Choice bikers, and they explained to me in sort of broken English, French as their native language, that there were no freelance sellers of hashish in Saint-Anne-de-Bellevue, Quebec, the West Island of Montreal. And I'd had my nose broken and my money taken. And anyway, that was my next trip. And then the third trip, my girlfriend had left me, and to show her how romantic I was, I in a drunken stupor, I slashed my wrists. And so my last trip to the emergency ward was, I'm now sober. It's like 3 o'clock in the morning. And all I remember feeling then was embarrassed. Just, I wanted to make a do-over. Like, just, I was going to have to wear long sleeve shirts for the rest of the summer just to hide the reality of what I'd done. And I would have rather been dead than to have to sort of explain sober, what had happened. And yeah, it was just awful. None of these things scared me sober. So I'd been to AA, and it wasn't until my cousin came to Montreal from Toronto, I was told who wanted to get sober and could I take her to a few meetings? And I said, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I got sober the way everyone got sober in early A. I can't turn that off. You'll just have to listen to it if you hear the ringing. but it will stop. You know, because what did I see in my cousin that I didn't see in me? Looking back now, I saw a life worth saving. And I didn't see that in myself. And I didn't think I had the integrity to stay sober. I didn't think I was, you know, when I heard there, some of those are those unfortunates, the, you know, chronically incapable of being honest with themselves. I'm paraphrasing, of course. You know, yeah, that could be me. And, but I was going to do whatever it takes to help my cousin. And, you know, the days started piling on, right? November 28th and November 29th, and then December 1st and December 10th. And then I've already signed up for a young people's conference the first weekend in January in St. Jerome, Quebec, just north of Montreal. So I'm kind of committed to that because, you know, I'm not going to not show up because I said I would. And so that got me through Christmas and New Year's. And I met people from all over, Newport and New York and Boston and other parts of Canada, just all teenagers, people in their 20s. You know, we had an international volleyball game where nobody kept score. You know, there was a dance. I didn't know people danced sober. Like, you'll have to explain that to me, but yeah, it's catchy. you know, there was a lot of things that when I left there, I heard sobriety spoken in my own language. I heard people talking about, you know, getting back in their bands or going back to school or finding meaningful employment that gave value to themselves and others and how good they felt about themselves. People were trying to tell me that ever since I first came to my first meeting. There was no one who didn't want me to get sober that I know of. And now I could hear it because it was spoken in my language, you know, teenager to teenager or young person to young person. And so that pamphlet helped quite a bit. And because I read those things and then, you know, and then eventually I met other teenagers. In fact, when I see people who are young in recovery, I often, you know, there's the young people's pamphlet that's constantly changing, which I think is great. And also there's the membership survey that shows that 1% of AA members are under the age of 20. And so that's 20,000 people in recovery from alcoholism who never had a legal drink. If you put them all together, that'd be a pretty impressive arena of young people in AA. And they're doing a new, the International Conference of Young People in AA. There was some audio and visual captured, and they're preparing right now a anonymous, you know, however they're going to do it, capture of that, again, to help carry the message young person to young person, because no teenager would look at me and see anything they wanted or see in me someone who could understand what they're going through. I can't imagine they would. And because I don't speak their language, I really don't. I've been there. But you know, my experience was quite different. And you know, I could tell them how to fold a map, and they'd say, "What's a map?" You know, you know, it's like how much help could I bring, really? And I think all of these pamphlets, all of these attempts to say, we know what you're going through. We've been there too. Here's our story. I love the fact that they're updated constantly. I know that the general sir, one of the delays in the new copy of the book Alcoholics Anonymous, they're putting out a new edition, is there were so many stories offered, and over half the book is just one alcoholic talking to another. And again, the idea was we want to show the diversity of the experience of addiction and recovery from all walks of life, all socioeconomic groups, all cultural backgrounds. And AA heard the call and responded, and they've had to take on new readers just to get through the piles of stories of, and I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to our fifth edition of Alcoholics Anonymous for the stories especially. And the font, I always curious what the new font will be. So I outgrew being a teenager, but I didn't outgrow being an atheist. And again, like actually being one of the members who started the YES group, Youth Enjoying Sobriety, in Montreal, having access to secular AA, atheist and agnostic groups, and it's the same AA, no prayer, AA works and always has. Again, it's talking my language, and I like it. And having that there, I also feel like, you know, an equal and one of many in any AA group. I really do. And if I feel for a moment that I don't know, I don't belong here, you know, it's just a few more days until my home group meets again, and I'll be good. Because, you know, every meeting can have a bad day. This meeting, maybe you'll have to tell me later. And you know, so the other thing I will tell people if they're new, one of the jobs I haven't done in a long time, but answering the phones at the intergroup office. I've done that in Montreal, and I've done that in Calgary, Alberta, and I've done that in Toronto. And I remember the surprise of my coworker, the person answering the phones on another desk, when they could tell I had what we would call a wet one. You know, someone who's sober curious, someone who's wondering if they have a problem and what to do with it. And and they could hear me say, "So you're thinking of going to an AA meeting to find out?" And so they don't have a call; they're just listening to me talking to this person. And I say, "Bad idea." The AA member, of course, is shocked, and so is the person on the other line. And I said, "It's a bad idea to make such an important decision in your life based on one meeting, one night or afternoon or morning, whatever time you go to your meeting. Because, you know, it's not a formula. It won't be the same every meeting you go to and every night. AA isn't McDonald's. It's not the same eating experience. It's not the same atmosphere. It's not the same price range. It's not the same, look and feel at every AA meeting you go to. We're kind of ma and pa shops, and there's a different cook in the kitchen every week, you know, a different chairperson, a different format, a different. And so if you're curious about AA, I think that's a really good idea to find out about AA, but maybe go to a dozen meetings in over the next couple of weeks. And the ones you really like, go back to them. Find what works for you. You'll find your people out there. I have, and I'm sure you will too. And that is the most amazing thing about AA, is that every person who decides we should start a meeting on such and such a night in such a place, and they have to sit down and think, okay, what are we going to read something? What's our format going to be? And that's sort of like the first group conscience. And then they'll do that. And then other people will join and change it. And they might quit. That's okay. They'll probably go somewhere else. I'm glad Ward is here. I don't mean to embarrass him, but he is a non-alcoholic trustee emeritus, and I remember him going around in 2011 thinking, you know, AA, you guys do such a good job. What you really need is a pamphlet for the atheists and agnostics. Isn't that a good idea? Because, you know, some of them, like a lot of people come in here, one of their big barriers for staying is, we do talk about God quite a bit, which he was all in favor for. It was his business. He is, I think in the U.S., Episcopalian, you please correct me if I got that wrong, a minister. And our non-alcoholic trustees are people who love AA and work for nothing to help the still suffering alcoholic find AA, and in some regards help us from not, you know, burning crosses at each other's meetings or whatever. they sort of help smooth. They bring a real sober second thought to a lot of what we do. But in 2011, that was a time in the AA I was in, I could see a polarization of AA. In the AA I came to, there wasn't much of that at all. No one ever challenged me on, no one ever used the term real alcoholic. No one challenged me on my worldview. If I said something that wasn't, you know, a official story, they just said, thanks for sharing. And, but 2011 was a time when, you know, there was sort of the radical free thinkers, there was fundamentalism. Most of AA lived in the middle and, you know, wasn't part of that. But there was, in some of the meetings I went to, I saw a mean-spiritedness that I hadn't seen when I first came to AA. And it concerned me, it concerned Ward. And you know, it's a lot of what we try to do to make things better in our home group or AA as a whole won't happen while we're in the room. And we eventually did, thanks to the people in the UK, got our atheists and agnostics pamphlet, and it was agreed upon by the General Service Conference in Canada and the US to adapt and amend that. So now it's available in Spanish, French, and English. And it's what we always wanted. It's atheists and agnostics telling their story in their own language, their candid approach to Alcoholics Anonymous, what works and what doesn't. And we have that now. And I think we have a lot going for us now. Like, I've always been a big fan of living sober, but honestly, some of its recommendations, like crochet and some of its language, is maybe it's time for a little revamp there too. But it spoke the language of the day. 40 years of AA experience, based on hundreds of thousands of AA case studies, it really did offer. Here's 31 ideas that have worked for us. Interestingly enough, there's one a day for I run a meeting where sometimes we read from that, and I just pick whatever day of the month that's the chapter we read. It's just a simple way of doing things, and it's well designed for that. It's short and sweet, and it stands in the shadow of some of our other the primary literature, but over 7 million copies have been sold. I mean, that would be outstanding, again, if it wasn't in the shadow of a big book that sold 40 million copies. But it helped me, and I know it's helped a lot of people. But I really think AA comes down to one alcoholic talking to another, listening to each other, and with the steps, without the steps, with a version of the steps, or exactly as written. That's AA in action, I think. And it really is like one day at a time. Like Patrick, I teared up when he was talking about that time in the 90s. I was busy. I had two young children, career problems, a mortgage, stress, but I had a friend in need. And I remember saying to Patrick, I'm busy, but you matter to me, and I've got time for you. Always have, always will. And I remember saying that, and it was like I was watching myself say it. Like, I didn't even know I had that kind of integrity. Like, I didn't when I got here. It was a byproduct. There's no integrity step. It's a byproduct of the other work and the steps, the traditions, and so on and so forth. And Patrick's paying the price for that now. Like, there's no spiking the ball. I win. I'm super sober. Like, I'm back working on post-traumatic stress disorder issues because the symptoms are, interfering with my happiness today, and I have to, sort of start again. And so Patrick's, on the receiving end of that. I helped him, and it's cost him dearly. But it's always a two-way street. That's the great, this is the last thing I'll say. That's the great democracy of AA. Someone who's still reeking of booze, and someone who's 47 years sober, has something to say that is of equal value in every AA meeting. When I go to put on a meeting at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health in Toronto in their detox with other group members, it's always the person with the least amount of sobriety that gives the 20-minute talk, because it's most relatable. Like, there's nobody in that detox who wants to sign up for the AA 40-year plan. That's like too life sentences, right? They don't want what I have. They really don't. And I'm not offended by that. But someone with 8 months sobriety, that might be something. Can you tell me about that? You know, I'm listening, you know, that might reach them in a way that, you know, I'm not even credible. You know, I'm happy to read something or share, you know, what's going on for me today. But, you know, like I know how this works. People have to hear from people they can relate to. And I think that's the great thing about AA. Thanks everybody. You know, like I really thought this wasn't a big day. I wasn't even going to say anything about it, but I'm happy you're here. I'm happy I'm still around, and until next time, thanks everybody.